Hey everybody, what's going on? It's episode 147. It's Tone Talk with Mark and Dave, and we've got a killer guest tonight. We've got Greg Leon of Greg Leon Invasion. He's from formerly of Dokken, Quiet Riot, Sweet 19, which is a predecessor of Motley Crue. We'll get into all of that stuff. How you doing, Greg?
I'm excellent. How are you guys doing? Actually, I'm a lot better. I had the worst holiday season ever. I wound up in the hospital for the first time in my life.
Oh, shit.
And ended up having my gallbladder taken out. It was ready to explode.
Oh, boy.
All full of infection. It was great. It was right before Thanksgiving. And then, you know, they loaded me up with all these antibiotics to kill the infection, did the operation. That part went fine. And then since my immune system was down, I got shingles. And that is the worst thing you can ever get. Pain-wise, and it was huge, and I'm still getting over it, and here it is January 18th, 2024. Wow. So that's over 2 months.
I hear that's a bear.
Yeah.
It's. I wanted to kill myself. I wouldn't wish this on my drummer, just so you know.
Yeah, it's Mark takes that personally because that's his first instrument.
That's why I took a guitar. It was too many drummer jokes and bass player jokes.
Every good guitar player, it seems like they started out on drums. You know, I talked to Frank Marino. Oh, I was a drummer. I still play drums. I go, well, me too. I still play drums. Hmm. Eddie Van Halen.
Eddie Van Halen. Drummer.
Yeah. It's the weirdest thing.
Getting into that, I think that it helps your rhythm for sure.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, I can stay in the pocket with, you know, and I got to have a sense of one.
Absolutely.
And, you know, and all that stuff. So
one, what is that? What is that one thing you're talking about?
The 1-4-5.
No. Oh.
So, Dave, what's up with you, man? What are you drinking tonight?
Some tequila that Pete Thorne got me.
Oh, sweet.
I like that guy. I like Pete.
Cheers, Pete.
Oh, I see Mike Torn in the chat there.
Yeah,
we had to do this on a Thursday night.
Yeah, we're throwing everyone off here.
Yeah, I'm sorry, guys. My daughter's birthday is tomorrow night. We have we've got a dinner for her and this whole thing that we're going to, and so I could not make it work for the usual Friday night. So we figured we'd squeeze it in. And get it in, get Greg in before
our viewers are coming in.
Yeah, people will start trickling in. And then I'm traveling the following week, and so it's just kind of tough.
I have the NAMM show. Oh boy!
Oh, that's right. Yeah, you're going to NAMM show. Yeah. When is that? That's next week.
Yeah, that's next week. That's me starting Wednesday at setup.
Yeah, we're still on the fence to go or not. Dave, I got to tell you, man, you know, I've had a few of your amps come in here.
Mm-hmm.
Never anything wrong with them. It's maybe a bad tube or, you know, something like that. But the build quality and the tone, my God, you can plug straight in and get the best sound you ever had in your life. If you can't get a sound with your amps, you don't even know what you're looking for because they are fantastic.
Thank you.
And your guitars, my God, this guy Thorn brought in a guitar from you.
Oh, yeah, I know Thorn.
Unbelievable. Yep. That guitar, yep. I couldn't get over the sustain and the resonance and just how wonderful it was.
Mm-hmm.
It's incredible. Yeah. So God bless you, man. I mean, you're doing the shit right.
I'm trying. Yeah,
no, I'm not just saying that either. I tell people that, what's the best amp I could get? I go, well, they're a little expensive, but your search is going to be over.
Yeah. You know, yeah. Especially if you want that, you know, hot rodded English vein, you know.
I like that. Yeah. I do a lot. I really do like that.
I figured you did.
Yes.
You're a Marshall kind of guy.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, I just worked on that. It's a 71 Super Bass. It started life out as the one that I rented to Eddie Van Halen for the Beat It solo through Andy Brower. I worked on it yesterday and put some Zoso caps in there.
Oh, yeah? Oh,
God. And that thing just woke. I couldn't quit playing last night. It just sounded amazing.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, 90 volts on the Variac and just a couple of 412. A 412 Marshall cabinet, 25 watt greenbacks, heaven, just perfect.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
You ever do any playing out anymore or once in a while?
We played at the it's funny, this is episode 147. On May 31st, we played the Whiskey and we drew 147 people and just killed them. I mean, people were up taking pictures of my pedal board. Uh-huh. You know, it was the stupidest thing. I mean, it was like all these people, hey, he used to be in Dokken. You know, he was in you know, actually, when I joined Quiet Riot, when Randy left, I was Randy's favorite local guitar player. And we used to rehearse at the same place in Burbank called Visions. It was in Burbank. And mm-hmm. I get the call from Kevin and Randy when he got the Aussie gig and asked me if, you know, because I knew all the songs. We'd done a bunch of gigs together and, you know, we're hanging out at Randy's house and stuff. And so I took the gig and we were going to call it Quiet Riot, but we decided Kevin decided we're going to change the name to Dubrow until we get a record deal. But he was so hard to work with.
I remember that.
And, you know, I'm 5'7". He was, I think, 6'2 or 3". And I was like 100, 115, 117 pounds back then. And I literally am the first band. You can check this with the guys that were in the band, Drew Forsythe and Gary Van Dyke. I brought in the two Slade albums with Come On, Feel the Noise and Come On, Mama, We're All Crazy Now. And we almost went to blows. He went crazy when I said that. I don't know why the hell he flipped out. My whole point was we need to get a song like Van Halen's You Really Got Me, something that we can get on the radio, get it heard, and something that's like opens the door for us. But man, he went nuts. He did not want to do it. And that was the first argument we got into. But I got to say, as hard as it was to work with him, because everything was his way or no way, and he would argue everything. He was the most fun guy to hang out with if you wanted to party. We had the best times in the world. I mean, and I remember Randy telling me before he left, he goes, "You're going to learn to hate him, but he is going to make you the best guitar player that you can be." And I never forgot Randy telling me that, and it was totally true.
Wow.
How long were you playing with
about 9 months, I'm thinking. And then Don Dokken had been after me since the old days and at the Rock Corporation. We're talking right out of high school. So I graduated in 76. It was probably 77. We did a show with Dokken at a place called the Rock Corporation in Van Nuys. It's no longer there. But my road crew accidentally took all of Don's amp heads, and they were in my equipment van. And so I get a call the next morning, and it's Don Dokken, and I didn't know who he was. I just knew he was the guy from the band we played with the night before. And he goes, "Hey, man, I just got home. We're unloading our stuff. All of my heads are gone. I think you guys have them." I said, "I don't think so." He goes, "Well, would you do me a favor and look?" I said, "Sure. Give me a call back in 5 minutes." So sure enough, I opened up my van. There was his heads, and they were 50-watt or early 50-watt, the Baby Marshalls, just mm-hmm. wonderful sounding amps. So I said, "Yeah, I do have them." So I gave him the address, and he came up here. He was down in the South Bay, and I think Redondo Beach, and I'm up here in La Crescenta. Actually, I live in that same house now. Both my parents passed, and
mm-hmm.
I got the house. I got my studio here. I got a 24-track analog studio.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, wow. All my cars and my studio, my shop here. And anyways, but so Don comes up here. And
so you never leave, is what you're saying.
I never, there's no reason. And also, I have, you know, everybody knows, anybody that knows me knows I'm a fish connoisseur of tropical fish and breeding exotic tropicals. I've been doing it, been into the hobby since I was 6. I'm jumping around a little bit here, but you know, there was one time here at the house, I had 125 tanks in a warehouse in Van Nuys with 300 tanks. And I was
commercial.
Yeah, that's a lot of work, but it was so much money in it back then. I mean, my God, you could make, you could make $10,000 a month selling fish back then. Now you can't hardly give the stuff away because there's no pet stores. They're all the fish stores are gone, the mom and pops and the big chains. They just buy from the wholesale. Even the wholesales are going under. But anyways, Don comes up here and we're talking. He goes, "Man, I really dug your style and your singing, your voice. We should do something together." And I'm thinking, yeah, another guitar player that wants to play. I don't need another guitar player. So this one, every 2 or 3, 4 months, he would give me a call. "What are you doing? You would think about what I asked you." He goes, "I keep thinking about you." And, you know, and he always thought it was funny because every song that was original that I had back then was in the key of A. He goes, "Can't you play it any other key?" I go, "That fits my voice. I got a high voice." And so anyways, I was on the way out with Kevin. I was just looking for something else. And he called me up and he told me that he had some European dates. And I'm thinking Jimi Hendrix. He had to get away from the States, go over to Europe to make his mark. And so I go, "Are you serious, Don?" Because I didn't know him that well then. I just had talked to him a few times. And
so this is before George.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. This is like, I was in, oh, man, I got so many stories. I predicted the day before John Lennon got killed. And you can ask Don this. Don and I still talk. We're buddies. I predicted that one of the Beatles was going to die. And the next morning, the headline said John Lennon shot dead in New York. And I had this weird, and I'm psychical. My dad was the same way. I got this feeling over me. And I walked into the room where we all were, and I go, man, I got the weirdest feeling, guys. You know how Jimi Hendrix died? All the early bands, that Jimi Hendrix died. One of the Rolling Stones died, the Doors, Janis Joplin. I started naming all these people. And I go, but nothing ever happened to the Beatles. I go, I got the weirdest feeling. I can't shake it. I just wanted to tell somebody. Left it at that. We wake up the next morning. Headlines, John Lennon shot dead in New York. And they just looked at me, man, if you got any weird feelings about me, keep it to yourself, man.
Wow. That's really, let's go play the lottery.
Yeah, I wish I had those, man. I wish I had those. I don't have that, though. My wife's lucky with that, though. She's always playing lotto and all these scratchers, and is always calling me, hey, I just won $50. I just won $100. I just doubled my money, you know. But my dad was like that. He was always playing. And the fact, we're going all over. Is this cool to just riff?
Yeah, man. Go take the stream of consciences.
Okay.
That's fine. I like that. It makes it more interesting.
When the lotto first came to California, and it was once, I think it was on a Wednesday night, my dad, his dream was to win the lottery, set up the family, because we grew up really poor. I mean, my dad was a barber. Sometimes he'd have one haircut because everybody had long hair. My hair, hell, my hair was down to my waist, and all of his old guys that he'd been cutting hair for years were dying off, and, you know, the Beatles and all the heavy metal band. But anyways, so every week he played the same numbers. He had five numbers. He would, and it was a buck a number. And one day my mom goes, his name was Major. She goes, Major, why the hell you keep spending that money? We don't even have any money. And you keep throwing it away on that damn lottery. Nobody ever wins that lottery. And I guess she guilted him out. I was there. I saw it. And, so he didn't play that week. So he watches it that night, and every number that he'd been playing came up. And he was just sick. It was $4 million back then. He was sick. He couldn't even look at my mom for a long time. He was so disgusted.
That might have been time for divorce. Yeah. No.
I couldn't afford that, you know.
Yeah, I don't know, man.
Crazy shit in my life, man. I'll never forget my dad, but he was just, he wasn't the same after that, man. Because his boat came in and he missed it. You know, of one time.
That's rough. So, yeah. So going back to Dokken. So you were in there before you got, before George was in there. Right. How long before George was in there were you?
I was there right until I left. Okay. And I'll tell you why I left. It wasn't any reason. There was a couple of reasons, but I won't get into those. We went over to Europe. We played a bunch of shows. People went crazy. I mean, you ever remember that guy Speedy from, the Scorpion, Speedy's Coming? That's actually a guy, and this guy is like the biggest male groupie over there. He just follows bands around. Well, he got wind of us, started showing up at all of our shows. And one night I'm doing my guitar solo, and I see all of the people, and this was a place called the Fabrik in I think it was Hamburg, Germany, and I see all the people. The place was full, and I'm looking, all the eyes are looking up above me, and I'm, well, that's weird. So I'm doing my solo, and I hit a note and hit the tremolo and bend it down. I look back, and this guy, Speedy, is up in the rafters in his underwear, just screaming and hanging up there. And the crowd's going crazy. They all know who this guy is. Even the Scorpions wrote a song about him. And so it was great. I mean, when we come back to the States, we did the Starwood. We did the Troubadour. We didn't do the Troubadour. I hate the Troubadour. We did the Starwood. We did the Whiskey. I don't believe we played the Roxy. No, we did Whiskey and Starwood. And we did our showcases for record labels. And everybody at these record labels at that time, it was 1980, you know, we're not signing any more guitar bands. That's over. Van Halen was the last guitar band, you know, and we're like, no, you guys don't even realize what's coming. We were just in Europe. This shit is coming right now. You wait till it gets there. And we were great. I mean, the band was great. Don, I, Gary, and Gary Link, Gary Holland, Gary Link, and Don and me had four-part harmonies in every song just about. It was like Boston when the choruses came. It was amazing. We couldn't get a record deal. They all kept saying, you guys need to cut your hair. You need to get some ties and get rid of those stupid bell bottoms. Get rid of the leather. And they were handed, one label guy handed us a stack of records. It was like the Knack and all these new wave bands that were like, there were nothing like that, but this is what's coming. And it was coming because they wanted it to come. But, you know, after about 6 months of getting back, I just said, you know what? I'm just going to do my own thing. I was always happy doing, you know, the Greg Leon thing or Sweet 19 or whatever. So I called up I just decided to quit. I just got said, shit, it doesn't look like it's going to happen. So while we were in Europe, Dieter Dierks come and caught a show. He took us into a studio in Cologne, Germany, and he did a 5-song demo with us. And super nice guy, super smart. You know, he knows how to get great guitar sounds. And I had a 410. What's that?
I said, I know who he is. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I over there, the whole tour, I used a 410 Marshall. When I first saw it, I'm going, oh, man. Because I always play with a minimum 2 stacks, sometimes up to 5 of my stacks.
Yeah.
Depending on big places. Yeah, and I had this 410 early Marshall, you know, running on 240 volts. I plugged into it. And I had this little 6-band MXR graphic EQ that I put different ICs in to get rid of the noise.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was about it. A wah-wah. And I think I had a phase shifter back then. But anyway, so I plugged into that thing and hit one A chord. And I was like, oh, my God, this is the sound. This is the sound. So then I was happy. And poor Don got stuck with this little PV212 thing for the tour. And we, you know, Dieter took us in the studio and we did this 5-song demo. And one day, we just did vocals and everything one day, you know. And that's what got him his record deal with Carrera. You know, and it introduced him to Dieter and him doing the work with the Scorpions and stuff. But I talked to Don. Don called me actually right when Jeff Beck passed away. And we were talking. I go, you know, Don, I think the only regret that I have is leaving the band, Talking Band, because it wasn't about the music. It was just all these labels saying you're not going to be able to do anything because nobody's signed. And it just got to me. And I figured, well, I can lose on my own or make it on my own, but I don't want to go down with something that they're saying is a sinking ship and this is a passe thing. They said it's going to go the way of the doo-wop bands. And I'm thinking, you know, what's that a hell of a thing to say to some people, you know?
When did Docking eventually get signed? It was like, what, 82?
I think about 82. Yeah, I got the Carrera deal. And George and I, we're still friends. We played a bunch of shows back at the Starwood days in the late 70s. He had a band called Exciter. And before that was a band called The Boys, or One Way or the Other. And they were great. I always used to tell him, dude, you got to turn all the echo and flangers and shit off. Because he's in the zone where in the sweet spot where it sounds great, but out in the audience you couldn't understand what he was doing, and we've all been guilty of that, you know.
He's almost still that way to this day.
He's one of the funniest guys I've ever met.
He's hysterical. Yeah,
hysterical. When you get
by the way behind you, Dave, you got a Lynch Mob case.
That's one of George's amps that I just fixed.
What nice. Is it?
It's a 50-watt Plexi that he's been using that's set up to use with Variac and 90 volts and biased for that, that is. And it's,
you know, you were talking...
got Sylvania 60A7s in it.
What volts did you say? Does he have it?
90 volts.
90 volts, okay.
Yeah. You know, you were mentioned with... I watched a podcast of yours with George Metropoulos the other day, and you were talking about rebiasing the amps for when you go down to 90 volts.
Yeah.
I've never rebiased them. I just turned my amps down. I've never had a problem. They sound phenomenal.
No, it's not a problem. I just think it might sound better if you rebias it for 90 volts.
I'm going to try it.
And you can bias it a lot hotter, you know, because obviously you've dropped your play voltage now down to like 300 and odd some volts or 350-ish, depending on what your amp is. And, so this is something that kind of came up. I always kind of knew about that, but that sort of came up when I worked on restoring Ed's amp. And I surmised from things that I had read over time, you have to do a little like hunting and pecking it through things that were said over time, that he was a guy that always would... if there's a knob or something to turn, he's going to turn it. And he said, I surmise this. He said he turned the bias knob inside the amp till the tubes practically melted.
Oh, wow.
So hotter current, right?
Yeah.
And like all, you just like the pot, wherever that sat, who knows where that sat exactly. So I'm like, okay, so if he did that and then dropped it on to 90 volts on a Variac, I had a Marshall there, and I was like, well, let's see. Now, the average thing, I don't know. At a regular wall voltage, that sets it around 80 mils for the tubes. But when you dropped it on the Variac, it was then down to 50.
Which is weird.
And at 50, it's like totally almost accurate to be the right spot for it to sit with that Variac at 90 volts. Interesting. And so now I just generally buy some at 50 for 90 volt deal. Oh. for an old, you know, an old Marshall. And that's what I did in George's amp. He wanted that. Can you put the 6087, do the Ed thing with it? I'm like, yeah. That's and also Ed's amp had a 50K mid pot.
Right. Mine does too. Yeah.
And, that always fixes the, you know, on a lot of Marshalls, if you're cranking everything, and if you crank the treble, there's a crashing sort of effect that you hear until you bring the treble back to like 8.
Yeah.
But with the 50K mid pot, that crashing thing goes away.
Yeah. I used to go to, when I got out, I took electronics all through school, from electricity in junior high and then television repair and every class they had in high school. And I had a full scholarship to DeVry, which I did go to for a while, but I ended up leaving after a couple months because all it was math all day, every day math.
Yeah.
Didn't touch anything except a pencil, a slide rule. So one night in the middle of the night, I got in my 59 El Camino, drove back home, and 7 o'clock in the morning, my dad's getting ready to go to work, and I knock on the door, and they're all hugging me and glad I'm back. But what was I going to say? Through high school, I was fixing people's amps and stuff, and wah-wahs, I came up, you know, with that mod where you change the 470 ohm resistor, you drop it a little bit, and everybody wanted me to do that to their wah-wahs and stuff. So I was doing that in high school, and then
that wah trick. Then if you did that early, then fucking Jerry Blajas at Amp Crazy,
thank you,
stole it.
I worked for him for a while.
Oh, did you? And took that and then encapsulated the resistor in a little block of black bullshit. it was like a 100 ohm resistor or something that he put in there and make the super boosted
330 or 220, depending on where you wanted it. But
I do that later too, because I found out what that was eventually when I was getting into all this stuff, and then I would modify WAS, but with a variable a rotary switch, and it would just change the resistor values.
I did that, you know, too.
Anywhere from 470 vintage to 100 and everywhere in between, and, you know, put a true bypass in the wall and, you know, all the fun stuff. And
bingo.
and that's where, you know, why not? Hey, that's cool. I like that. Okay. Let's elaborate on that a bit.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it was fun though, man. You know, it was all new back then. Nobody had anything. There was no pedals out there. You had a fuzz phase, a Foxy Lady fuzz, and then in 1974 the Phase 90 came out. It actually made me go get a job because I wanted a Phase 90. I got a job at the hospital where my mom worked, and I told myself I was going to quit as soon as I got the, because I think they were $100 or something like that. And again, you know, I grew up in a family, you know, we didn't have a whole lot of money, and that was a very frivolous to go out and spend $100 on a little guitar thing. So I got that. And then the, what was it called? Jet Phaser came out.
Oh yeah.
And I thought, oh man, if I had a Jet Phaser, that would be awesome. I bought all this stuff from Charles Music, and they just give me stuff and let me pay it off or whatever. But man, what a time that was,
man. I remember what you just said. Boy, if I just had that one pedal.
Yeah. I remember
said every guitar player to their mother or family ever.
Yeah. I remember thinking, because I was always a Hendrix fan. I love Frank Marino. I love Hendrix. And I'm watching Band of Gypsies, you know, and he's got three Marshall stacks behind him. I just had three Marshall stacks. I could do that. That's what I don't have. So I get three Marshall stacks. It still sounds like me, just 10 times louder.
Right, you know? Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Oh my God. I remember, man, we are just jumping around, but I remember I was friends with Chris Holmes, still friends with Chris Holmes, but he had all these stolen amps that he had stripped all the covering off. He used to loan them to Eddie. And so we're doing the Star with this one time, and he goes, hey, you want to borrow my amps? I go, yeah, man. So he brings over 6 cabinets that are all stripped out. It's the same ones that Van Halen was using. I had them in my living room, and you know, we put them in the old VW van and got them down to the Starwood, and I just thought I was God. I look behind me and, you know, and you see your shadow, and it was just like, man, this is what it's about. You know, and I'm playing through one cabinet, you know, and all the rest are just there for show.
Yeah, it's funny you say that, because somebody wrote me, I don't know how long ago it was, but they, Dave, remember we were talking about, someone wrote on our show not too long ago. They're like, I know the secret of Eddie's cabinet. Yeah. Well, then someone wrote me on the side, and they're like, is it that they were stolen, and that's the reason why the Tolex was taken off of them?
That's exactly why they were stripped.
And people are like always thinking, well, the reason why they were stripped is because it was some tonal thing.
Yeah. He didn't want people to be able to recognize. And it wasn't Eddie that stole him. It wasn't Eddie.
Right.
Yeah.
I met Eddie twice. I hung out with him once. I partied with him one night at a place called the Wood Sound in Monrovia. This guy, Phil, owned it. We were playing there all the time. Danny Johnson from Axis and Rick Derringer's wife at the time, Cheryl, was booking the place. And we were all friends. Danny and I had a rehearsal room together. So we're playing there all the time. And I kept, my sisters would go there and dance and hang out. And they'd tell me that Dave Roth was there buying everybody drinks. And a couple of times on the weekends, I don't know why or how, but they said that they hung out with Ian Gillan. And he bought everybody drinks, just hanging out with all these gorgeous young girls. And so anyways, I told Phil, I go, hey, man, the next time Eddie's coming down, let me know. I love Eddie. You know, and I'd met him once before, but we were in his backyard 2 o'clock in the morning after 3 o'clock in the morning after we came back from the Wood Sound in Pasadena. We knew where he lived. And he comes back home with this little light-colored Peugeot, I think it was like a powdered blue, and talked in his backyard for about 45 minutes in the cold, and he invited us to go see them record the next day at Sunset Sound. So we went there, and Dave kicked us out. He goes, we're doing vocals, man. We can't have people hanging around. I go, well, Eddie said we could come down. He goes, well, I'm saying you can't. So we went in the car, we left, and we laughed. Fuck, we just got kicked out by Dave Roth. How awesome is that, you know? Because we're all, you know, anyway, so Phil calls me this one time and he goes, hey, Eddie called and said he's on his way down. So I jumped in my car and I ran out to the Wood Sound. He goes, just come straight back to the office. So I went back there. There's Eddie Van Halen. We got a guitar in there. We're doing lines for hours and hours. And that guy, man, he could party. And, you know, we're handing the guitar back and forth. And I'm sitting here because I was such a Hendrix fan. I never got to meet him. He died the week that I started playing guitar, and I'm there sitting looking at like this, and we're handing a guitar back and forth, and I'm thinking to myself, this is the best guitar player on the planet, and here I am sitting with this guy that every, including myself, this is the guy, you know, and I just never forgot it. It was such an experience to.
Not bad.
And he was totally cool. I mean, we just hung out like we've been friends for years. I didn't know him from. He didn't know me.
Yeah.
You know, we had met in his backyard once, and in the middle of the night, he probably didn't remember that. But I just remember leaving there that night, all coked out of my mind, and you know, I'm just like, what the fuck, man? I was just hanging with Eddie Van Halen. You know, it was just, I remember putting our hands up to one another. I go, let me see how big your hands, because he could stretch his fingers like crazy, and our fingers were the same length. We put that line there, put our fingers together, and they were the exact same length. They don't look good here, though. Except his fingers were thinner than mine. I got kind of sausagey type fingers, but man, it was just awesome. Awesome how great he was, and he was so cool back then, you know. And
Do you ever see them live and like at a, you know, like backyard party or anything?
I never saw him at a backyard party. The first time I saw Van Halen was the first time I saw Quiet Riot, and that was at Glendale College. And my drummer at the time, Brian Goodnight, was the head custodian, LA Unified School District. That was his place. So earlier in the day, he went and put reserved things on the seats right in front of the stage, the first row center. So we had our seats there, which total bogus, but nobody sat down there. So we got our seats. And I didn't know what I was getting into. Never heard of Van Halen. And I don't know how I didn't know of Van Halen, because all of my friends knew who they were. But I don't know if they were, you know, scared I'd get mad they were going to see another band and not me, or what it was, because I was playing all the time. But anyway, so we sit down there and Quiet Riot comes out, and Randy's just awesome. He looked great, and the band was great. Apparently he had the flu that day. I didn't know that. So after they finished, I went backstage to meet him. I wound up in Van Halen's dressing room before they even came out, went and met Randy and Drew. And Drew and I are still friends. We spent a couple of our birthdays together in Hawaii. My wife and all the four of us. And anyway, so that was awesome. I met Randy before they were really anything. They were just like a local kind of phenomenon. And I saw Van Halen, and my God, I'm thinking, what in the hell? They had those big walls of stacks behind them, and they were just incredible. I thought his sound was, if I remember right, his sound was a little thin, but it was the best band I'd ever seen. And Dave Roth, I'm total heterosexual, just so you guys know, because I know you're questioning it, but this next time I say, he was the sexiest guy that I'd ever seen. And I remember thinking to myself, God, I'm glad I didn't bring my girlfriend. I do remember thinking that, but he was awesome. I mean, he was
what year was it?
I think 78, I think. Okay, I'm not so really sure. There's flyers out on that.
After they were signed.
No, they weren't signed yet.
Oh, so it's gotta be earlier then.
Yeah. Well, maybe. Oh yeah, you're right. No, I guess 77. It might have been 77. I know they weren't signed yet. I don't think they were. But I just, and then I went backstage and I met them, but I couldn't meet them. They were just too many people back there, and I didn't meet them then. But I just remember thinking, geez, I really got to step up my game, because he was just doing weird patterns, you know, and I'm playing Johnny Winter and Richie Blackmore type stuff and Hendrix and Frank Marino. And here's this guy, just these weird patterns that don't, they shouldn't make any sense, but they sound great. And, you know, sliding across the fretboard, you know, just all that cool stuff. So that was a wake-up call to really start pushing yourself to become.
That was a wake-up call to every guitar player.
So many
people that I know said the first time they ever put on that first record, and they just like, they're like, what the fuck do we do now?
Yeah, now what? Now what?
Now what?
I mean, if you just, a lot of people overlook it, but the beginning of atomic punk, that,
yeah,
you know, with the phaser going on, and
yeah,
he's just rubbing his hand against the strings, yeah, you know, and making that noise
with a really loud amp,
right? Yeah. But it sounds incredible. It was so different than anything that anybody was doing,
and just those false harmonics, like I'm the one where,
yeah,
I was like a machine going. It's like, I remember, I it was right when that came out. I couldn't, you know, he's doing the Eruption, he's doing the hammer-ons. Nobody knew what the hell he was doing. But I went and saw Black Oak, Arkansas at the Starwood. And they had this 15-year-old guitar player who's dead now. What the hell was it? Sean Lane was playing with him. Well, he comes out there and he's doing all this stuff. And I go, oh, that's how that happens. That's how you do that. So I went home and figured out how to do that. But it was Sean Lane that I actually saw do it. And that kid was amazing, that Sean Lane guy.
Yeah.
Man, but yeah, Black Oak, they were a trip, man. What a trip.
Well, isn't that where David Lee Roth?
Supposedly, yeah, I think he probably did.
Ripped off some of the moves.
Yeah.
And the look.
Yeah. Yeah, all for right. Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember, and I've told this story a bunch of times. I was playing at a party at the Chevy Chase Country Club, and a high school friend of mine was putting on this party, Martin Oliver. And there was probably 300 people there in the rec room, you know, because we played parties every weekend just about. And I'm playing, and I look out right near the door, and I see these two guys. Never seen them before. And this is when I was in high school. And I'm thinking to myself, man, those guys are in a band, or those guys are somebody. What are they doing here? But they came to check me out. And so I take a little break, and they come up to me. And I had a 63 Fender Jaguar at the time. And Eddie goes, how do you get that thing to do those dive bombs like that? And I go, I took that. There's one spring in there, and I don't know who these guys are. I go, I took two pairs of pliers, and I pulled them apart. Now I got more travel, and it's the arm is way back, so I can go down farther. It would always come right back in tune if you didn't have many windings on the headstock. And they stuck around. I didn't see them again until I saw them, you know, play with Quiet Riot at the Glendale College. But as soon as they walked out, I go, oh, that's those two guys. It was Dave and Eddie. And that was the kind of stuff that was happening here in Southern California and Glendale, Pasadena, Burbank. You know, Randy was around. I was around. George was a little bit further south. I never saw them play except at the Starwood. And then when we played with them at the Starwood, but they were playing all the time at the Starwood. Yeah.
Yeah. Man, you were there like right at the.
Yeah, it was amazing.
Right at the beginning of it all.
Yeah, the peak the beginning and the peak. And then you also saw, we were talking last night, the rise and the decline.
Yeah.
It
was, you know, so amazing. God, for so long, it just seemed like it was never going to end. it was sold out almost every night, 7 nights a week. You could go out and there was just people there in line. And on Sunset Boulevard, all the way from Clark Street to, I think it's Doheny or whatever it is, where the whiskey starts, all the way past Gazzari's, two Gazzari's, I should say, was just, I mean, just
a wall to wall people.
It was wall to wall people, or as my old best friends, a nut to butt people. I mean, it was just ridiculous. And hot chicks, hot dudes. I mean, it was just, if you couldn't hook up in that situation, just go home and kill yourself. I mean, it was amazing. And all the amazing thing is,
I'm sorry to interrupt you. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, and everybody was, you know, hawking their bands, trying to hand out posters and stuff, and our flyers were playing here. And it just got to the point where it got kind of cheesy. You know, like I always used to wear black, and I would kind of, I remember, interview with Ritchie Blackmore. You know, he separated himself from it. He didn't just always hang out all the time, because then kind of the mystique's gone. And I was trying to build some type of mystique at the time. So if I went out, I never tried to, and I'd always have other people put up our posters. You know, they'd have a pickup mm-hmm. truck, and a couple of guys would go out with a staple gun and just, you know, shout. And then we almost got arrested one night. And I laughed at when the cop said, he goes, "I'm going to arrest you guys for littering." And I'm thinking, no, we're just promoting our show. But to him, it was littering. It just struck me very funny at the time.
Yeah, I was going to say, the Sunset Strip, you know, I was thinking back to even when the Doors, I mean, back in the 60s. So, I mean, it was popular for a long time, and now it's just dead.
It's dead. Although we did play there in May 31st of last year, 2024, and it was packed. I mean, we went in. It was the first time that I ever made money playing there. They gave me a check for $1,600 for an hour set, because they had a supposedly a meet and greet thing that they charged the people in the, there was like, it was either two, three or four booths back there, and they charged the people like $100 a piece,
mm-hmm.
and you get all the drinks up to $100 and you get to meet the bands and stuff. I didn't know they did that. Mm-hmm. And so when we were packing up and getting ready to leave, the guy goes, "Hey, don't forget to pick up your check." And I'm thinking, oh shit, I owe them money. Oh fuck, man. You know, but they gave me a check, and I showed it to my guys, and I told them, "You guys can split this. I'll cash it tomorrow, and you guys split amongst yourselves. This is just a three-piece band." But we killed that night. I mean, like I said, I don't know if it was while we're talking here, but there was people up, because I hadn't played in L.A. for so long. I mean, we've been to Europe and stuff like that, the East Coast, and people are taking pictures of my pedal board. You know, I'm just playing with two half stacks, and I had two JCM 900s that I was playing through, and then my pedal board and, you know, my Les Pauls. That's the first gig I ever played where I didn't have a Strat it was all just a Les Pauls the whole night. I don't know how that happened, but
what's on your pedal board?
Well, the first thing is, actually I got one of your pedals, Dave. I got it from Thorne, actually, in a trade. I can't think of the name of it right now.
BOD Dirty Shirley or
Dirty Shirley. It's like that though.
Golden Pearl.
No.
Buxom no. Boost.
One more. Come on, give me one more.
That's all.
That's it.
No, it's maybe it is the
BOD. Maybe, I don't know. Is it High Gain?
My two favorite pedals, and I've got everything. I mean, I've been collecting the shit since I was a kid, is your pedal and the Green Rhino. Those are the two that I think are the best overdrives.
Is it a Golden Pearl?
No. I could go get it if we had a minute, but I can't, but it's amazing. It's just, if you want it clean and transparent, you can get it clean and transparent. You can get it where you turn it on, you don't even hear a change.
Well, that's got to be the Buxom Boost then. Is it white?
No.
Is it gold?
Oh, is it small box or?
Could be the small box.
I think it's small box. For some reason is going on. But the thing is fantastic. And that's
a good pedal.
I've got, like I said, I got original 808s, 9s, 10s, OD1s, OD2s. I mean, all the super, all this crap. None of them come close to yours and the Green Rhino. I told George that too, George Trips. I said, "Man, you know, you really got a good ear and a good tech, because this is the shit that people want. It makes you play better. You know, gets you."
We have to have George Trips on. We got to. We keep.
He said after NAMM.
Oh yeah,
I did talk to him.
Nice. He's okay, a nice guy. Yeah.
I've known George forever. He was my first employee.
Is that right?
Ever. Yeah. He used to work for me.
Really? Wow. That's cool, man. Mm-hmm.
By the way, Greg worked with Andy Brower.
Yeah. I was doing, when I had my shop in Hollywood, I was doing his amp repairs, but he drove me crazy after a while. I just couldn't take him anymore.
Shocking.
That's what we were talking about last night.
Shocking. With a straight face.
Shocking.
Oh, God. But, yeah, I remember I got a amp from him that belonged to Walter Becker. And he was all worried about this thing, you know, that's the sound. And it was a Fender Tremolux. And so I took it to my shop and it had burned it and the output transformer.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was the output. It's been so long, I don't remember. But I remember I opened it up and I was able to get enough of the leads that didn't burn so I could just put, you know, wires extended to it. So I saved it. And I remember I gave it back to Andy and it went over to Hawaii. And Walter sent me the nicest letter. And that, when you plugged into that and played it, you could hear that sound. There was something in that amp that would compress down and come back. And that was that sound that they had, or he had in, what do you call it? His band. I can't think of the name right now.
Steely Dan?
Yeah, Steely Dan. And, but yeah, he wrote me the nicest letter, just thanking me that I saved his amp. And, you know, it was just putting some extensions on the wires and, you know, so nothing was shorting out again. So,
yeah.
It wasn't a hard deal.
What a great guitar player.
Underrated. Yeah. What a great band.
I know Dina, or Dave, you don't like Steely Dan. That's right. We were talking about that with your wife.
I mean, you know, it's just, I don't know. It's fine. I don't hate it, but I don't,
yeah, I'm with
not
you.
Really like, I'm just like, okay, yeah. You know, sure. I'm not a huge fan.
They're a little too highbrow for me, but yeah, there's a few songs that are great.
They are highbrow. It's a good description.
Yeah.
One of my best friends, that's his favorite band in the world. Have you ever get in his car, go anywhere with him? That's all he plays.
Yeah, I mean, I could listen to it for a little while, but it's kind of like a phase I'll go through for a little bit, and then I'll be like, all right, listen to something.
Have you guys interviewed, or are you into Frank Marino at all?
He's great. Yeah, he's great. I mean, we haven't interviewed him or anything.
You should. I've talked to him quite a few times on the phone, and he's super nice guy. Oh my God, you'll love interviewing him.
I see him. Correct me if I'm wrong. He toured with Return to Forever for a little while.
I don't know.
Maybe
I don't
not.
Know.
Replacing.
I can get you. I have his phone number if you want to call him. He's
no. It was Frank Gambale.
Yeah, totally different guy.
Yeah, totally, very different.
Yeah, I'm thinking a totally different guy.
Now Frank is. I listened to Frank Marino since probably 1972, religiously ever since. And when I got his phone number, I sat on it for about a year and a half. And my best friend Mark Tate was at the house. We're sitting up here at the table. And we're talking about Frank, because we're both Frank Marino heads. And I took my phone and opened it up and I go, look what I got. And he goes, oh, bullshit. That's not his. I go, no, I swear that's his number. Mm-hmm. And he goes, well, where'd you get it? And I said, the guy that did the interview for Burn Magazine for me gave it to me, because I told him all about Frank, because he didn't know anything about Frank Marino. I gave him questions to ask him. So he goes, man, you did me a solid. That was one of the best interviews I ever did. So I go, well, now it's time for you to do me a solid. And I go, I want his phone number. But I sat on it for like a year, year and a half, maybe even 2 years. And we're sitting at my table. He lives in Toronto, so it's 3 hours different than Southern California. And I didn't think about that. And I called him up. First ring, he picks up, and I know it's him. I go, hi, is Frank there? He goes, yeah, this is me. Who's this? And I tell him, it's Greg Leon. And I go, you know, and I told him who I was, what I had done, just so he didn't think I'm some idiot calling him up, you know. And we talked for an hour and 17 minutes, I think, when I opened my phone at the end. It was an hour and 17 minutes. We talked about amps. We talked about transformers. We talked about guitars, string gauge, everything. And I called him about, and he wanted me to find him a real 65 Fender Twin Reverb output transformer. That's his favorite.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought I had one coming to me in a 65 amp, but it was a 75 amp. And so I called him back a little later. And I guess he had put me in his thing, because as soon as he goes, hey, Greg, what's up? I'm like, whoa. That's cool, you know, because I was such a big fan. I was like, what am I going to ask him about? It'd be like getting in touch with Jimi Hendrix. Hey, man, I really dig you, man. And just another idiot, you know. How do I get out of this phone call, you know? Oh, shit, my ride's here. I got to go. No, you know, that one of those things.
That's funny. Hey, before I forget, guys, we have our sponsors for our show. Make sure you check out Sweetwater. We have a link below, which is our affiliate link. If you plan on buying anything from Sweetwater, make sure you use our link, please, and purchase all kinds of stuff going on at Sweetwater.
I have bought so much stuff from Sweetwater. I'm embarrassed to say how much stuff I bought, and they stand behind their stuff. If you have any issues, they overnight you a replacement.
Yeah.
It's amazing. So they get my thumbs up too. When I went to my 24 track tape machine, I had to buy a bunch more stuff. 1176s and LA2As and a couple of a bunch of stuff. And I ended up finding out about Warm Audio, which I just loved to death. And my God, it's a bottomless hole when you own a studio. Oh man, it's always something you want or you think you need.
I can imagine. Yeah. Yeah,
especially an analog studio.
Yeah. But nothing sounds, they're getting close. But, bass drums and snares, they don't sound the same with digital to me. I can tell right away the way they compress it. It just doesn't even sound like a tom, the snare, it's just doesn't have that low end.
Right. But Sweetwater, guys, check out. They have a January clearance sale. So it's up to 40% off on their clearance stuff. And that ends January 31st. So make sure you check that out. Also check out fixpedalboards.com. They've got, all kinds of accessories for your pedal boards. So, check them out as well. All right. And also lastly, Tomon, check out our link below about for Tomon as well. All right. And then I was going to switch over to Super Chat that we've got. Greg, you seem like a wonderful person. Thanks. Any other comments on Marino or Dirks?
I just love Frank Marino. I think he's an absolute genius. He says, how do you come up with these crazy riffs and these weird time signatures? And I mean, if you listen to Mahogany Rush 4, there's some of the craziest, coolest stuff on there. And he goes, it was because of the LSD trip when I took 50 hits. He goes, I can still do that. He goes, I wouldn't be who I am today had I not done that. He goes, I'm not advocating for, drug use. He goes, I don't touch drugs or alcohol since then. And he goes, but I can recall it. And how we started to play guitar, he told me, was that there was a guitar at the hospital that he was recuperating at, and he could concentrate on something else rather than let his mind just wander off, because it wasn't turning off the acid, And so he just started concentrating on that, and that was his relief and his release from a distraction. And thank God that happened,
Wow.
But I don't know too much about Dieter Dirks. I just spent a little time with him in Europe with when I was with Dokken, but he was a great guy. He was wonderful. Loved my guitar tone. He always remarked on my vibrato. He loved my vibrato. And that's really, I just spent the one day with him, and we did that 5-song demo.
That's cool. We've got John W777. Thank you. Hey guys, love the channel. Dave, have a drink or two on me at NAMM. Thanks for the quick turnaround on my run 50, you rock.
Well, that would be two drinks probably for the amount of money.
Okay.
Two and drinks. Ma'am, that would be two.
Charles Ray, Greg is the best. Great Amp Tech too.
Oh, thank you, man. That's you.
Awesome. We got Serious Amplification. What's up, man?
Hey, man.
Spartan says these are great stories. So let's go back.
Where are we going?
We're gonna go back way in time. So let's talk about, how did you first meet Tommy Lee? How did that come about?
He was following my band Sweet 19, and Gary Holland was my drummer at the time. And Gary and I played together, one of the best drummers on the planet. I talked to Gary today. And I don't know what happened. We had a falling out somehow. He doesn't know what happened. I don't know what happened. But Tommy had been following me, saying, man, you need me in your band. I love what you're doing. And so, but he was this little kid. He was like 17 or 18, and I'm 21 at the time. And I'm thinking, it's a kid, and I'm still a kid myself. So anyways, Gary split, and I run into Tommy, and he said, I got a rehearsal place and I got a bass player, and just give me a try. So I went over there, and he had his friend John over there, and the bass player from his, I think they had a band called US 101 or something like that. And they were pretty much a cover band. But Tommy was just freaking amazing from the first drum hit he hit when I got into his dad, David, had built him a rehearsal studio because his dad knew how talented he was, built a room inside of a room inside of their garage, and his parents' bedroom was right above it. We'd rehearse there. I was staying with him. We were rehearsing whenever we felt like it, the middle of the night, early in the morning. It didn't even matter because they couldn't hear it upstairs. And Tommy was always phenomenal. His meter was always great. He was always a showman. The bass player's mother was a booking agent, so we were playing all the time. We're playing, you know, high schools, colleges. I think we did play. We played this girls' Catholic school once, and I won't go into what Tommy was saying behind my back when I'm getting my money from the nun that was paying me, but it was killing me because I grew up in a Catholic family. And you have reverence for these people, which he had none. So he's back in his, I'm going to say what he said. What the hell? We're all adults here. So I'm like at the front of the stage and the nuns, they're paying me. And Tommy's bent over and he's loading up his stuff. And behind my back, I keep hearing him go, "Suck it, bitch. Suck it." Just loud enough for me to hear, but the lady couldn't hear. And I'm like, I'm trying not to laugh. And I'm thinking, man, I hope she doesn't hear this. Man, we're going to go to hell if she hears this, you know. And I finally got the money, and I go, what the hell? He goes, I'm just trying to make you laugh, you know. And, oh, my God. But the way he was saying it was like a devil, or suck it, bitch. You know, with his but, oh, like, he was funny.
That makes a whole lot of sense.
Yeah, I could see that.
He was funny, man. And he had that town where he was in West Covina, and I was staying out there at his folks' place with him. And I remember one night he had two beds in his bedroom, and I was sleeping in one, he was sleeping in the other. I know you guys thought I slept with him, but I didn't. No. And so I wake up in the middle of the night one night, and he's doing he's sound asleep. He's doing a drum solo on his pillow and tapping on the wall. And I just sat there. I'm just going, this guy's his whole world is drums. I mean, he's drumming in his sleep. I swear to God that happened. And he was always great. And then I got the call from Randy and Kevin, and I left, and man, they were so mad. His folks, his sister wouldn't talk to me. He was upset. And I said, dude, let me go make a name for myself, you know, and I'll come back and I'll get you. So I did the Quiet Rider, the Dubrow thing, and then the Dokken thing. And when that was done, I came back and we were putting the band together, and we were out looking for a bass player. And he's happy all of a sudden. He's happy again. His folks are happy. We're playing together. And we went to the Starwood, and London was playing, which was Nikki Sixx's band. And they ended, and Tommy kept going, man, that's the guy. I love him. He looks so good. He looks great. But he's not going to be able to do what I want to do or what you want to do, you know, because I wanted a band like, you know, something like Rainbow or Deep Purple or Humble Pie or Foghat. Some real good low end grooving on the bass and stuff, and then I can play over it and stuff. And he's not going to be able to do that, you know. I've known Nikki too long, and so I said, "You can do whatever you want. I'll introduce you if you want." So I introduced him to him, and they wanted me to play originally. I said, "I'm not interested. I just come out of Dokken and the Dubrow thing, and I didn't want to be a sideman anymore, you know. Even though I did sing in both those bands, lead on a couple of few songs, I just wanted to do my own thing, you know. And with Tommy, it was amazing." But he made the right decision, because I had never found good enough music. Now I got a great band together. I got a new, where is it right there? New band, new album. Oh, cool. And we'll talk about the record industry. This is my fourth album. The record industry in a minute, how sad state of affairs that is.
But oh, yeah.
Nobody knows that. But so I told him, you can do whatever you want. I can't tell you what to do. I go, but... you know, Nicky's got great ideas, but he's the best looking guy. Him and Rick Fox are the two best looking guys on the scene. There's no two ways about it, but they're not the musicians that I was looking for. I wanted to get really step up, you know, because I was practicing my ass off at the time. And so I went on and put together Greg Leon Invasion. And how I came up with the name Invasion was I was at a Van Halen concert. It wasn't Van Halen. It was like a, there was must have been 10 or 12 bad, I think Scorpions and Van Halen. But this kid sitting in front of me had a t-shirt on that said Van Halen World Invasion. And I remember sitting there, and it's hotter than shit. And I'm sitting in the seat, and I go, man, Invasion, what a great name. what a great term. That's what I want to do. I want to invade the world, you know? And I brought it back to the guys in the band the next day. I had Joey Vera from Armored Saint was my bass player at the time. And then Carl James from, he was in a bunch of different bands, but he was in the band with me. But I asked them what they thought about that name. Cause we were just calling it Greg Glenn. I go, I want to have a band name, you know, cause everybody's going to think I'm all stuck up or something. It was just, everybody knew who I was. That's why I used my name. Cause I could draw people in with that.
Right.
And that's a whole definitely truth story that I'll tell you about that in a second. So I asked the guy, what do you think of the Greg Leon invasion? They said, let's do it. That's great. It's got a good ring to it. So we did that. And I'd used that for a long time. And then Vinnie Vincent decided he was going to use that. And so unfortunately, I had to get my lawyer to go after him because I'd been using that name and released an album. And, you know, Chrysalis Records calls me up, tells me I got to lose the name. And, you know, our client, new client's got it. You know, he's going to use the name regardless. And I said, well, you should be talking to my lawyer. And Ron Fair from Chrysalis Records goes, oh, who's your lawyer, little Greg Leon? And man, when I heard little Greg Leon, I go, this mother, oh man. I go, it's Stan Diamond. I think you know who he is. Well, all of a sudden it got quiet. I go, I'll have him call you Monday. So we settled out of court, had to change the name. I went from packing out every single place I played to pulling 15, 20 people because nobody knew when martial law was playing. And that was like part, I was on a trajectory going up for a long time. Labels were then after that, it was just like starting over again. It was the stupidest thing I ever did was let go of that name back in that time when that was the kind of music the labels were looking for. So that was a huge mistake. And then you get some money and you go through the money. You got nothing to show for it. You got a couple of amps, a couple of good. In fact, this guitar here, this 56 Les Paul is all I have to show for that. And I only paid $190 for it. It was in the recycler. I got out of my lawyer's office, went downstairs. There was a bank downstairs. I cashed my check. I grabbed a recycler. And my dad and mom drove with me because they were scared something would happen to me with all of that money. And so I pulled a recycler. I get in the car. I pulled over to the side and I looked. And there was said Les Paul guitar, $190. So I went to a payphone. I called. This is like, I don't know, 81, 82, something like that, 83, maybe 84. I don't know, whatever he got his deal with Chrysalis. So I called this number and this old man answered. I go, hey, do you still have that guitar that's in the recycle? He goes, yeah. And I go, $190? And I go, where are you? And he was about, I don't know, 2 miles from where I was in Hollywood. I get over to his place in his apartment. He opens the door. It's this guitar and it's in the old alligator type cases. And I go, why are you selling it? He goes, I don't play guitar. I had a roommate here and he stiffed me for $190. I just want to get the remainder of the rent. So I gave him $190. And now this guitar is like $8,500 now, you know? And
yeah.
A little bit of scratch on the back from one night at the.
That's a sweet guitar. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's amazing, amazing guitar. But I've used this thing forever. I've recorded with it. I've done 100 gigs with it. I don't take it out with me anymore though. They're just getting too valuable, some of these things.
Oh, sure, for sure.
Yep. Yeah, they're going up. They're going up. Yeah. Chris Quinn got a super chat. Just picked up a 66 Bassman AB165. Can you talk a bit about that circuit, channel differences, and cool possibilities for them? Are you familiar with that circuit, guys?
Me? Usually on those, the easiest thing to do is get everything working right. And there's a 250 picofarad capacitor. I change it to a 500 picofarad capacitor. And that'll get you probably right where you want to be. I've done it with all of mine. I've got a bunch of basements that I have, even the Bandmasters and Showmans. It just gives you just more of what you want out of the amp because they're getting held back by that 250 picofarad.
That's you mean the treble cap?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's all I really do to those to make them sound better.
I mean, the AB165 is, you know what always amazes me is how many different blackface basement circuits there actually are. Mm-hmm. And you're like, oh my God. Yeah. I mean, like, what were they? I mean, I wonder what they're thinking at the time. Were they just experimenting and having fun?
They must have been. Hey, this works.
You know, the AB165 is like, you know, the standard Fender preamps, but then it goes into another tube stage. Yeah. Before it hits the phase inverter, then some of them are just like a standard black-faced amp, like a Deluxe or like a Super or whatever, which are all the same. You know, the most black-faced amps, other than the Bassman, are really all the exact same amp, except the power sections are different, or they put a mid knob on, or they didn't put a mid knob on, but the mid was fixed with a resistor. And, you know, it's really all the same. It was, someone says, "Oh, I like that deluxe tone." I go, "Well, that's the same as a twin, really. It's just a smaller power section," or, you know.
Yep, exactly. But
the Bassmans, on the other hand, though, there's many different versions of them. And I don't know if I've always liked the AB-165 version that as much, but...
I love the Fender Electric Bassmans, man. Those are just, man, something about them. The black bass.
That band, brown face bandmaster over there behind me with the harmonic tremolo.
Yeah.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, the first good amp I ever had was a Bandmaster. It wasn't that one, though. But yeah. I got it at a pawn shop in Glendale, and it was $60. And, man, I thought I hit the jackpot. And I had a $6 guitar that my mom had to go in and sign for me because I was underage. But that guitar, I used that guitar all through, I mean, that amp all through high school. Had a stupid big muff. I wouldn't leave home without it. I mean, I was just, man, and a couple hundred gigs probably with that amp. I still got it. It's a 64. It's a great amp, but it doesn't do what your amps do, where, you know, a really, really good Marshall.
Yeah, it's different. It's a different
thing. It is totally different, yeah.
So the Campbell 5150 says, have Greg tell the story of Yngwie snubbing him. Hysterical.
Yeah, that's hilarious. That we were playing at the Troubadour in L.A., and we did our sound check, and people kept coming up. Greg, you got to watch this next guy coming up. It's like nothing you ever seen. And I'm, what are you talking about? No, this guitar player, Stingray Valve Stem or something like that is his name. Nobody could pronounce Yngwie or, you know, Ringworm or I don't know what the hell his name is. So anyways, I waited around and I watched his kid come out, and he's got a half stack, a 50 watt half stack. And I think he had one pedal, a little yellow pedal and a Strat. And I watched him warm up and I'm like, whoa, who in the hell can play that fast and that clean and that articulate? So I watched the sound check, and I was just blown away. I'd never seen nothing like it. I don't think anybody had.
No.
He was so good, so good. And so I go back, I follow him upstairs, and I walk over to him, and he's on one knee tying his shoe. I go, dude, I got to tell you, you're probably the best guitar player I've ever seen. And he looks up at me. He goes, yeah, I know. And he went back to tying his shoe. Didn't shake my hand. Nothing. Just like he'd heard it a million times, which he probably had. And so years passed by. We have a mutual friend, Albert Morris, and Albert and I went to dinner with him at the Rainbow. And then we went to his show. I think it was on Vine Street, the Avalon, I think is what it was called. So we're backstage and we're hanging, and everybody's telling Yngwie stories and stuff. And so, you know, there's about a dozen of us maybe backstage. And I start telling that story, and he goes, oh my God, Greg, did I really say that to you? I go, yeah. He goes, I'm so sorry. I go, no, dude, that's one of my best stories. I love that story. And he apologized, and his wife comes up to him, and you know, his shirt was open to here all the way down to his belly button. She takes him and slaps him right on the chest, and it left a big welt. And she goes, see, I told you, you can't be an asshole to people. You got to be nice, because nobody forgets nothing. And I go, that's one of my best stories. I don't knock him for that, you know. But that's the story the guy's talking about there. You know, if anybody's ever heard him play blues, he's one of the best blues players. If you get him to slow down and play, he's got incredible vibrato.
He does have incredible vibrato, just for sure.
Ridiculously good when he's playing straight blues. It's insane.
Yeah, in between the pick kicks, he's great.
Oh, my God.
He's a character. Talking
about kicks, I remember we were playing up north. I think it was a Pismo Beach concert, and this old theater with a wooden floor. And we were going from here all the way to San Francisco, then back. This is a long time ago. And we come out for an encore, and I go to the edge of the stage, and somebody must have spilled a Coke or something. And I had Capizios on, you know, those little white shoes with the leather sole and the wood floor and Coke. I run out to the edge of the stage and I stop, you know, and I just kept going. My feet went out from under me. I thought I broke my back. I couldn't breathe. I'm sitting at the edge of the stage and go, man, be cool, be cool, be cool, be cool, you're going to be okay, you know? So I finally got up to my feet, the crowd, they knew I got hurt. And, but it's crazy shit like that when you're on stage. And we finished a set out, but I'll never forget it. Look before you leap, you know?
But yeah, like, that's for sure. You can get hurt out there. So you guys are still playing? Are you guys still gigging?
Yeah, we are, but there's no real places to play in LA. I mean, you can't play the Rocks anymore unless you're with, what's it called?
Live Nation.
Live Nation. Mm-hmm. If you're not with them, you're not playing there. So that was my favorite place to play locally. Mm-hmm. And I met my wife. We were playing at the, what do you call it? That was in Hollywood. It was a big room in Hollywood. It's gone now.
House of Blues?
House of Blues. We played a Randy Rhoads tribute on December 6th, his birthday. And I don't do tribute stuff. I play my own music. In fact, I've been asked to play at 100 of those, you know, Randy Rhoads tribute. They want me to play Quiet Riot music or Aussie music. I don't do that, you know. I do what I do, and that's what I want to do. I don't spend a bunch of time learning somebody else's stuff. And I did that when I joined, you know, Kevin. I had to learn all that stuff, which was fine, but I'm 65 now. I don't need to be doing that stuff, you know. I just lost my train of thought.
Playing places.
Oh yeah, we are still playing out. We're looking for shows right now. I actually have a few record companies. There's one contract that I keep getting, but you know what? There's no deals no more. But they're basically distribution deals. They put no money into it. You got to give them a finished product. Nobody buys CDs no more, so there's just no income. And after the COVID thing hit, there's most of the good clubs are gone. They couldn't hang on for 3 years. So it's just terrible right now. And I'll play anywhere, you know, as long as I'm not going into the hole. I'll play locally for free. I don't care. I just want to get out and play and have fun and see my old friends and stuff. But my drummer, my bass player, my drummer's played on over 400 CDs. He's an in-demand session guy. So he demands to get paid for gigs, which is fine. But most gigs in LA, they don't give you guarantees, and you know, you don't know if you're going to make any money. My bass player, he plays in the LA Philharmonic Orchestra, so he's first chair cello. Mm-hmm. And these are guys that are totally schooled. I'm 100% self-taught, you know. So, and my bass player doesn't care about the money either, he just wants to play like I do. So, it's just hard finding gigs. We've only done three gigs with this new band, this new lineup, and we got together right before the pandemic. And when the pandemic hit, I had all these songs. I said, let's just do a record, man. I don't know if you guys can see that. I'm all backwards here.
Yeah.
Yep. So, what about the Baked Potato?
Yeah, somebody else mentioned that. Do they do hard rock there?
I don't know. That's a good question. Maybe in some, maybe. Couldn't you? Well, you said you played the Whiskey, though, not that long ago, ago or whatever. Probably do that again if it was successful. So they'd probably
They would have us back.
They would probably welcome you back if it was successful a year ago. Yeah. Why not?
It was 5-6 months ago, and 147 people on a Wednesday night. I mean, that's pretty good for LA.
Yeah, so, and then there's the Bourbon Room.
What's the
Bourbon Room in Hollywood? That might be a possibility too.
I'll have to look into that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we were.
But you're right. There's not really a lot of places anymore. Yeah.
And when you get older too, and you know, I did Rocklahoma, and once I did that, I did Rocklahoma and played for like 50,000-60,000 people, and it's just deafening at the end of every song, the applause. And then they call me out later in the day because Steve Vai was supposed to be there to do the Star Spangled Banner, but he didn't show up. So the promoters came, Greg, would you do the Star Spangled Banner? It was right before somebody, I can't remember who it was. It was right when the sun was going down, I think. Anyway, so I said, yeah, I'll do it. So I went out and I did the Star Spangled, just me alone. I had three stacks behind me, went out there with my Univibe, you know, my Overdrive, and went out there and just killed it. And in the middle of it, which I didn't know you can get arrested for, which is bullshit, I did Somewhere Over the Rainbow with chords and moving chords and stuff. And then I went back into that and did, you know, the Hendrix end with all the dive bombs and the screams and all of that stuff. And I remember I saw Frank Marino do this once. At the end of his night, he just takes the guitar and leans it up against the amp and lets it feed back with a Univibe going, gung, 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 gung.
Yeah.
And the crowd's going crazy. And these idiots, nobody can figure out how to turn the amp off. I go, it's just hit the damn button on the top. It's right there, you know, the off and on button. So I went out there and turned it off. As soon as I reappeared again from behind the amps, I turned it off and grabbed my guitar and walked off stage. And I remember telling my wife and my band, and I go, if I never do another gig or never think anything else in my life, I did what I started out to do. Because I remember seeing Hendrix, you know, at Woodstock. Now, I didn't see it, but in the movie, playing that. And I just go, man, just to do that would be so, it would just do something to me that, you know, I had made it. Or I, you know, because I never got a hit record. And every time I have a record deal, they never know what the hell to do with me. And now they don't spend any money promoting because nobody buys records. So it's almost you got to do it because you love it and it's just in you and it's got to come out as Lonesome right. Dave used to say. And it's how it is now. It's terrible. Yeah. I got a deal with Sony and Bob Frank Distribution, and I was so happy. And the Orchard Distribution Worldwide, so happy. I got everything I wanted in the contract. They didn't do a damn thing. And this is with this record that I just showed, the Tell the Children record. It's available everywhere, but they didn't spend one penny on promotion. And I call them on it. They act like I'm disgruntled or something. I go, dude, you guys haven't done anything you promised me you're going to do. Why did I sign? Why'd you sign me? Right. This just wasted 2 years of my life. You know, I'm getting older. I don't have kind of time to waste with this crap. I give you guys a great record and you guys do nothing. And your excuse is, well, nobody buys CDs anymore. Well, then why'd you sign me? I was doing better selling them on my website. I had to take it down.
Yeah.
It's terrible out there, man. It's just not right. You know, I want to get bumper stickers made that says Lars was right.
You know? Only this is true. This is very true. I mean, for sure. I mean, you know, it is very true. You know, a lot of people do better these days with making vinyl.
Yeah.
You know, and doing
it's true.
And selling, because there's a whole, I have a 13-year-old son and he's into vinyl.
Wow.
I mean, like totally into vinyl. Like, and like he wants to buy the record and play the record and look at the record. And I'm like, going, that's awesome.
Yeah, that's cool. I got rid of most of my records and I had three, I don't know how I ended up with three really nice turntables. I gave them all away to a guy and he ended up taking to a swap meet and selling them. I thought he was going to use them. And I got rid of a bunch of records, but I got, you know, the Quiet Riot records that Randy gave me when they did the first two records that were Japan only. I still got those. And I got this is kind of funny. Chris Holmes kept telling me about, we were sharing a bass player when I first met him when we were 19 and I had Sweet 19 and Don Peterson was my bass player at the time. And he kept talking about this band, the Scorpions and Uli Roth and Ulrich Roth and this, that, and the other. And, but he had lent it to Eddie Van Halen, the CDs, the early CDs. And I go, get those back. Let me hear them. You keep talking about this. So we get some back and Chris gives them to me and I played them. I said, you're never getting these back. And I still got those from back in, 77, probably 76. But man, in fact, I was trying to turn my wife. She likes the newer Scorpion stuff. I like the old stuff with Uli. And I played her, showed her a video of Sales of Sharon last night, which is just, that was so far ahead of its time. All that stuff that Uli was doing.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
I had a chance to play with Uli at UCLA, I think it was. This friend of mine, Greg, took me there. And I'm backstage. I met Uli and Don Dokken was there. And I think Warren DeMartini was there. And a bunch of people were there. And they all got up to play. But he didn't have anybody to sing some Cream songs. And Don goes, you should get Greg to do it. Greg's got probably the best voice back here. He hasn't burned it out or nothing, you know. So I'm talking to Uli. At the last minute, he got scared and brought Don out there to do it. And Don, because you should just get Greg to do it, man. So that was my brush with him. And he was super sweet, though. Really nice guy. Played his ass off. Just crazy good.
Yeah, great player.
Yeah, for sure. Great.
So so back in the day, when did you start fixing amps and like deciding that you wanted to do that? That's been a long time, right?
Yeah, it was high school. In junior high, I had this wah-wah that was called a Cromwell, and it was a Japanese thing. It had the siren, the swell.
I've seen one of those, yeah.
Yeah, Cromwell, a Japanese thing. And it took a shit on me, and I didn't know about electronics, so I took an old TV, an old radio, and cut all the resistors out of it and just replaced all the resistors in it, thinking it had to be one of those. Not realizing that every one of them was a different value. I totally ruined it. So I went up to Charles Music in Glendale, and they had a repair guy in there. He just looked and goes, I'll fix it, but don't call me on it. I'll just, when I get time, I'll fix it and give you a call when it's done, but don't bug me about it. I said, all right. So I get the call, hey, your Wawa's ready. And so anyways, I went to pick it up, and, you know, I'm in junior high school. I didn't have any money. So my dad drives me up there, and I go, how much is it? And the guy goes, 10 bucks. And I looked at my dad, and my dad takes 10 bucks out, and he looks at me and goes, if you're going to be a musician, you better learn how to fix this stuff. When school starts, you're going to enroll in electricity or electronics or something, because I can't afford, money doesn't grow on trees. I remember him telling me that, and you better learn how to fix this stuff. So I start, and I always loved opening stuff up and just, you know, seeing how things worked and stuff. And that's how it started. I started electricity in like seventh or eighth grade. And then we played I had a little three-piece band, as always, in junior high school, and they had a talent show. And I told the guy, let's do the talent show, man. We're always playing in my living room, and everybody after school comes, I think it's like a party here at my house. And so we did it. And I remember we put all of our, none of us drove. So in the early in the morning, we got, shopping carts. We put all of our equipment in shopping carts, and we just made a train. You know, we each pull in one and push in the other one.
Oh, my God, that's great.
And we walked down Glendale Avenue to Roosevelt Junior High School, put it all in the music room, and then we played. And I had a 64 Fender Deluxe. I had a Jaguar, either that or an old Hagstrom guitar. Bass player had a little Fender. I don't know what it was. And we did it, and the place went crazy. I mean, from that point on, I was like the star of the school, and that went into high school and on. But I remember, and then, so they had, the school was so big that they split the talent show in half. Well, most of the people from the first one cut the class and went to the second one. And from that point on, I mean, it was, everybody had parties just so we could play them. And we're making money, you know, just playing on the, we had a lot of money, maybe 40, 50 bucks we'd split, which was a lot for a kid. And we just kept moving from there. You know, I just loved it. And all the attention you get, and, you know, it was awesome.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. And I could always sing that. Thank God I could always sing, because that was always the problems in these other bands. They could never find singers, so they never went anywhere. But I could never find the right guys. You know, they'd be great for 6 months a year. They'd get disillusioned. They'd break up with a girl. There was always something standing in the way. You'd be starting over again.
It's the keeping a band together is got to be one of the most difficult things. It might be more difficult than Middle East peace. It's fucking hard, man. Absolutely. You know, it's just so crazy to keep a band together. It really is. It's rough, really, man. I went through it for so many years. Every, you know, singers, trying out singers.
Singers are a problem.
It's always a problem. Always.
I never wanted to sing. I just always could sing. And I remember auditioning guys that thought they were singers, and I'm showing them what I want them to do. And they were, fuck it, why don't you just do it? Then I'd intimidate them. Just go to this note here, you know? And my dad goes, Greg, you're wasting your time. Just sing. Your favorite guys are all singers, guitar players.
I think I'm convinced that Wolfgang Van Halen decided to sing on his own, because he's like, I saw the bullshit that my dad went through. At least that's my theory.
Yeah, I think he's crazy good. I think
he's so talented. Yeah, very talented. Very talented. Yeah. It is the thing that really gets me about him is, and I'd love to talk to him one day about it, is how he records all these songs himself, you know, and what's the progression of recording, and does he lay down the drums first, and, you know, and how does he do that? Is he making a chart of the music? Like, I've got all these questions for him. So one day when we have him on,
that'll happen eventually.
Yeah.
I did that on one of my rides. I'm working on my third record for my wife right now. And I played drums on a couple of songs and bass and keyboards. And the only thing I didn't do was sing lead. I sang harmonies with her. Hmm. But I would do a click track, and then I would put the guitars down. Then I would play with the click track and my guitars with the drums. Then I would erase the rhythm guitars. I didn't redo those when I get a good drum take. And then I just build it up from there like you normally would. So that's probably what he does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but the part that at least the way that, you know, and I haven't heard your music or your wife's music, but there's some parts that are just like super complicated, you know, and like different time where it's things that are like, you know, different beats at certain points, different breaks, yeah. and to get that stuff super tight,
yeah.
you know, as like doing it, you just yourself is, you know, even with a click, you know, to know where you're going to be with the guitar. I don't know. It's to me, it's because I've tried to record my, I play drums, guitar, and I can play a little bass, you know, just to do some background, you know, to do my music, but it's super hard to do it yourself. I just find it very hard. So, yeah. but yeah, it,
that's why I haven't done it again, because it is super hard. And I mean, each thing in itself is fine, but it's just getting it together where it doesn't sound like it's you doing it. You want right. to sound like a band. Yeah. And yeah, it's, and then, you know, with the stupid labels and stuff, and, you know, before, you know, you're trying to get that brass ring, you're giving it everything you got, you're going in the hole for stuff, you know, and you had me at going in the hole. No. you know, you're just really giving it your all, and you're, you know, sacrificing, you know, going out and stuff just to be the best musician you can be. And now it's almost like there's no payoff at the end of the tunnel. It's like Dave Ross says, the light at the end of the tunnel went out due to budget restraints. You know, it's just,
yeah. It's true. It's kind of sad. It's like, so you know, I'll still like refuse. Like if I want someone's music, I will buy it.
Yeah.
And because I kind of refuse to use like Spotify and stuff like that. Yes, I could. Have I for a split second? Sure. You know, just to hear something real quick or something. But, you know, if I want the album, I'll just buy it still.
Yeah.
I'll just pay the $10 or whatever it is to buy it. Cause at least I know that it's something's going to the musician, you know.
Are you buying any new music, or is it old stuff that you loved?
Oh no, I don't buy anything new.
Right on. I don't either, man. I got all.
Is there anything new that's good? I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure there is some, but
yes, there is right here. This is
there you go.
Man, this is great. Buy that. It's everywhere.
No, like if I don't have something and I want it right then and there because I have an idea in my head, I want to listen to it just because I don't have that. Okay, fuck it. Click. Yeah. And I'll just buy it.
So what I'm working on now. This shouldn't be there.
Yeah.
The best put together for me. And I'm probably going to do that because there's this label in New York that wants to do a best of Greg Leon, just like four songs off each record. And then I've got three songs from Sweet 19 that I came up from one of my old managers, sent them to me, put them on a CD. And now I got those, which I didn't even know still existed. So there'd be like 20 songs on this thing, but this label wanted to sign it. They're not going to do that. You know, it's going to be what I could do. Put it on, you know, so stupid when you read. Oh my God.
It's there's no money.
So sad. So sad.
It's tough. It's a tough business, unfortunately.
Okay. I'm going to go back to happier times right now.
Yeah. Let's do that.
In a minute. No. Everybody keeps asking about this Van Halen amp that I got, the one that he did the Beat It solo with. How I got that amp. There was a company called KSR Studios in Hollywood at Vine and Hollywood Boulevard. And they saw us play, this guy named George Renfro, and I'm pretty sure he owned the place. They had been out scouting for bands to produce and record in their studio. So they see us play at the Troubadour, and they say, hey, here's our card. We want to record you guys. So, you know, we don't have any money. We don't have any money. And he goes, we're not worried about the money. Well, let's see what we can do. We'll get you in the studio and record you. So we go in there, and this amp is sitting there against the door because the door, the way it was, it kept opening up. The big, thick door kept opening up. And so they would use that as a doorstop. And I go, can I put my bandmaster there as a doorstop and use that Marshall? The guy goes, yeah. So I was in heaven. I'd never really played through a Marshall, and it sounded so good. I'm just like really digging in. It was great. So I get a call the next day or 2 days later. Hey, it's George from KSR. You want that amp? I go, dude, you know, I don't have any. And this guy, it doesn't matter who he is, but George Renfro is his name. But he calls me up and asks me about that. I go, dude, you know, I don't have any money. He goes, no, do you want it? He goes, I've never seen anybody get more joy out of something than what I saw in your face when you were playing that amp. He goes, if you want it, just come and pick it up. I'll have my assistant bring it down to you. So I jumped in me and Gary, the drummer, Gary Holland, We jumped in my 67 MGB GT, drove down back to KSR. I rung the buzzer, third floor. This guy, Robin Kyle, comes down, brings it to the car, puts it in the back of my MG. And we're talking out there. And the bass player, we started getting close to getting a record deal. And he had he was scared of success, as far as I'm concerned, because every time we would get close to anything, he would freak out. And so anyways, he goes, I'm a bass player. I really dug your thing. And he was a really good looking guy, really good looking. He played his ass off and a super, just as easy to hang with. And that was the best Sweet 19 that that I think ever was with Robin. And we played the Starwood and we'd pull 500 people to the Starwood. I mean, it was insane. Mm. And then something happened at the Starwood with him and some other stuff. And that broke the band up. And that's when I joined Kevin and took the manager's place in that. But that's
so you get this amp.
Yeah.
And then tell the further story of this amp.
Well, I used it for years. And I remember when I first got it, I mean, it sounded great, but it was just, it was so loud and it was so, it was a super bass. It's a 71 super bass. It just had so much power in it. So I got a 6-band graphic EQ and that's what I use forever, but those are so noisy. So I put a double pull, double throat switch in it. And some guy told me about, what are they? Any
5532s.
Yeah. 5532 low noise op amp. So I put those and it got rid of almost all the noise. And I got rid of the low wind in it, and man, I had a killer sound. And I remember we were recording Kevin, Drew, me, and Gary Van Dyke. We were recording at the record plant in Hollywood. And I was getting my sound because we're doing our demo there. And I look out into the control room, and it's loaded with people. And it's Rod Stewart's band, but Rod Stewart wasn't there. Carmine Appice was there. All the guys in that era were in there. They said that's the best guitar sound we ever heard. And what I had was a 58 TV model Les Paul with Super 2 pickups in it from DiMarzio. And it with that amp and that 6-band graphic EQ, it was just brutal sounding. It was wonderful. And they all were just raving about, you know, asking me all these questions about it. I was using a Variac. And I just used it forever. Then I quit using it forever. I got into 5150s because I didn't worry if something happened to them. You could fix them or throw them away or whatever. And I ended up buying one off of that Eddie had given to, what was that band called? They used to be called Brunette. And then Neil Sean, my wife used to go out with Neil Sean, by the way. Neil Sean, she discovered this band and he did Getting Me Hot, Cherie. I Want What You Got All Over Me with a Hot Cherie.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe the band right now, damn it. But they used to be called Brunette. Anyway, she had heard that song and loved it and told Neil about it. So he went and saw him and he ended up joining him doing that record and they had a hit with it, that song rather. But I saw an ad in the Recycle years ago and it was 5150s and they were $120. So I went out there and picked a couple of them up and I'm talking to the guy and, he said that they were a gift from Eddie Van Halen. He doesn't use those. So he just wants to get rid of them. They're just cluttering up his garage. So I bought them to use them as loaners at my shop for people. But everybody kept coming back saying, God, that amp is amazing. I love it. And I started using them, you know, and variacking them down a bit because they're so cold, the bias on them. And then I fixed the bias on them and warmed them up. And they were actually pretty damn good. Put my Lexicons in the effects loop and they were good. But then all of a sudden, I just didn't like the way they sounded anymore. So I went back. A guy came in with some JCM 900s, and he had some other amps. He had like 5 amps with him. And when he went to pick them up, I remember trying it. I go, man, this damn thing sounds pretty good. So he comes back, goes, would you mind if I just gave you one of these amps and take the others rather than pay? He goes, I'm taking care of my mom, and I'm not working, and I really don't want to spend the money. He goes, you can have any amp you want. And I go, yeah, I'll take the Marshall if you don't mind. So I started using those and then I ended up buying 2 more of them. Now I'm back to the old Marshall again, the 71 that I modded, and I got a master volume. I've always had a master, but not always, but probably the last 25 years I've had a master volume in it. Just a simple one, you know, with a dual pot to the 220Ks. And sounds great. Just I was in the room last night just going, my God, how did I not realize what an amp this was?
Is it bass spec or is it lead spec?
Lead spec.
Okay.
Yeah. The bass is, it's too, although when it was bass spec, we were playing the Starwood and Mick Ralphs from Bad Company was sitting in with this band called Satter. They were sitting with Satter, and he asked if he could use my amp. And I'm a big, you know, bad company. So I was honored that he wanted to use it. Well, he chased me around all night wanting to buy that amp, kept throwing money at me. It only got up to $500, but this is like 78. So that was a lot of money, I guess, back then.
Yeah, you're right.
And I just said, no. He goes, that's the best sound in Marshall I've ever heard. And I'm going, that's why I'm not selling it, you know? And
it's worth a pretty penny.
Yeah, yeah.
And so this was rented from, or Andy Brower got it from you to rent.
Yeah. Yeah. He called me up and he goes, hey, you got that Marshall. Do you want to rent it to Eddie Van Halen? He's got to do a session and his stuff's in New York. He goes, I'll give you $100. I go, yeah, I'm in. So I dropped it off there the next day or 2 days later, I picked it up and ended up being the one they used on the Beat It solo. Every time I hear that song on the radio, I just have to smile. I go, man, the biggest selling song album of all time. And the part of it's my amp, you know?
Yeah, that's cool. That sounds
great. I went in the room last night. I did a little work on the amp yesterday. Went in because I was going to do this interview in my studio, but there's just so much stuff in there. And the lighting wouldn't have been right because it's real deep. I mean, I'm right against a wall right here. But maybe if we do another one, I'll do it. I haven't done any of the interviews in the studio. Plus, nobody needs to know all the shit I got anyways. But yeah,
I want to come over and see all the shit you got.
We live close together. I'm in La Crescenta. So.
Yeah, it's not that far. Yeah.
I met you at your shop. I don't know if you remember.
Yeah, I remember you were out there with from the Dave.
Yes.
From Def Leppard.
Yeah, good memory. My yep. God. Yeah, and I thought you were really cool, man. And your place was great, and their amps. I mean, I just become aware of you at that point. And I had played through a couple of your amps with people that have brought them in just for tubes. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, man, this guy is one smart guy. Because, man, this is what people want when they hear. They think they like a Marshall. But what they really are thinking they're going to get is what you got. Mm. You know, a lot of those Marshalls, they don't sound, they're not inspired. A lot of them are, but a lot of them are just, they're good amps, but they don't have that thing that inspires you to play. Pull right. stuff out of you, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Your amps do. I can't say enough good things about your amps.
That's awesome.
I've only seen them maybe a handful, maybe five or six, but every one of them's been amazing.
Yeah, that's great. Manuel Aparcio, Greg is the only one who repairs my amps. He is honest and never overpriced. Go Greg Leone.
Thank you, brother. Yeah, you know, I just, the way I look at it now, you know, I closed my big shop in Hollywood. I don't have a big overhead. I own my own home. You know, everything's paid for, and who's making money with music anymore? It's just an expensive hobby, and some of these guys that I know, they're just charging so much money for just swapping out tubes, and I see like $150, $200, $250 for swapping tubes out in bias just mm-hmm. for the labor. I'm going, oh, my God, these kids aren't making any money. They're just trying to learn an art, you know, and so I just try to help people out, you know.
Yeah, well, and, you know, that's great.
I'm busy all the time.
Well, that's great.
Higher price, you know, I'm not going to hurt myself, but I don't want to hurt them either. Because yeah. I get people coming and complaining about prices that they paid at some of these other places. In fact, I had a guy, I won't mention the name of the place he took me, this little Japanese guy came to me, really cute kid, and he was all frustrated. I was in Canada when he was trying to get in touch with me, visiting my wife's family. Mm-hmm. And so he didn't know if I died or quit doing it or whatever. So he finds this guy in Burbank. The guy has the amp for 12 weeks, hasn't even touched it. And so he calls him up, and the guy's really proper. You know, he's very polite. Japanese people are super polite. And the guy goes, I need more time with it. So he gives him another 6 or 8 weeks, whatever. The guy still hasn't touched it. So in the meantime, he gave it a try and called me. And I said, yeah, no, I'm here. Just drop it off. So the guy gets here. He tells me this story about how frustrated it is. And he leaves. And so he's piqued my curiosity now. So as soon as he leaves, I put it up on the bench. I fix it in about 10 minutes. I give the guy a call. He's just putting his key into his door. Hey, your amp's done. You can come pick it up. The guy rushes back, and he doesn't know me from anybody. And he just hugs me, and he goes, I love you. I love you. And he goes, I can't believe what I just went through and how easy you did it. And I don't even think I charged the guy. I mean, it was just so simple. I said, you know what? You've been through enough. Just go and rock out, man. Enjoy yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I look at it that way too, kind of. Yeah. You know, it's just like – I could, being, you know, the status I'm at now and whatever, I could probably charge through the roof.
Yeah,
I don't.
And like, if it really just took a half an hour to fix something, I don't charge a whole hour. I just charge for half an hour.
Exactly.
And give me a, and my rate isn't through the roof. I mean, it's a good amount, of course, but yeah, it's $80 an hour, but you know,
That's very fair.
I know that's fair. Right. Yeah. But you know, I if it takes a small amount of time, I go, just give me, give me $40 cash or something, you know, or sometimes if it's really small and you're like, oh, what do I owe you? I'm like, I don't know. You got $20 on you? I'll do stuff like that. If it really takes me 5 seconds to fix it,
that's great.
Or stuff, or, you know, if it takes longer, but the way I look at it is most all amp repairs take an hour.
Yeah.
Once in a while, there might be one that's 2 hours, but most amp repairs are like $80, you know, and plus parts, obviously, or anything you got to do. I mean, if you got to do a lot where you have to recap a whole amp and stuff, okay, maybe it's 2 hours a time and the parts and, you know, I just try to be realistic about it, you know, and because I make sure and people come back.
That's it.
They come back and back and back and back because you treated them great.
They tell everybody, and it's all good for everybody. I had a guy in yesterday, and I forget what I did for him. And he goes, I don't know how to thank you. I go, you can start with little kisses. So that was like, you know, the guy walked away laughing. I said, dude, you don't owe me nothing, man. I know what it was. It was an 846 Wawa that the battery clip came off. You know, it's a 29-cent part. I'm not going to charge a guy for that, you know.
Yeah. I've run into owning an amp company and having other techs do work on things in other states. And I remember some guy found a local guy and he had to replace 4 axial filter caps in the amp because we had a bad batch of caps at one point in time. 4 axial caps. I mean, like, easy as pie to do. And he took it to this guy. I said to him, I go, we can work with someone on something and we'll pay the fee and stuff. It's 4 caps. And I think I might have even sent him the caps.
Yeah.
So he contacts me back. He's like, okay, well, I had that repaired. And here's the invoice for it. And it was $400. I almost fell out of my chair.
Absolutely.
I go, I'm sorry, but there's no way that he should have charged you this amount of money. This was utterly ridiculous. And I don't know, you know, I literally had told him, the guy, I go, he doesn't have to do anything. He doesn't have to burn it in. He doesn't have to check for anything else. It's those 4 filter caps. Replace it, turn it on, make sure it works, and you're done. Your tubes were good. Everything was fine. That's all you got to do. Replace those 4 caps. I literally, it's probably a 20-minute job at max. $400. I literally almost fell out of my chair.
It's like a $50 job because remember you did the same thing for me, Dave.
Yeah, I mean,
he sent me 4 blue caps, right? Yeah. Remember those? Yeah.
And
I brought it to a local guy, and I probably could have done it myself. But
he charged you $50 or something, right?
It was great. Yeah,
I had the same story happen. I do all the amp repairs for True Tone for like the last 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And since Billy left, I think he went to Arizona or something. But anyways, I've been there like 18 or 20 years. Anyways, so they do shipping, and UPS took this amp, and they repackaged it, and it got ruined in shipping. But just the tubes broke. That was it. So the guy and it was back east. The guy takes it to a repair shop, or the Midwest, takes it to a repair shop to replace the tubes. The guy charged him for the tubes, charged him 4 hours labor at $150 an hour. So $600 labor. And I get this phone call, and the guy's, I go, dude, you should have called. Nobody is going to, it takes 5 minutes. You pull the old tubes out. And if they're broken in there, they should have. But yeah, it's just insane that nobody's going to go back to people like that. No. It's ridiculous. $600 to change some tubes plus the price of the tubes.
That's insane.
Well, that went on. They ended up having to split it with a guy, but it was still a come on. The UPS should have paid for it because they reboxed it. Whatever. What are you reading, Dave? You got a funny look on your face.
I'm reading some of the comments, and I'm like, a serious amplification. This our friends in Australia. He's like $400 for four caps. Yes, believe it or not, yes.
Yeah, you got to be fair with people, man. My dad always told me that, man. Just be fair.
Oh, he's funny. People. He goes, he might have been rubbing two sticks together to heat up his iron, hence the $100 US dollars per hour for the four caps. Yeah. You keep rubbing the stick together, the iron to heat up enough.
Very labor intensive. Very labor
intensive. Very labor intensive.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just people ripping people off.
It's unbelievable. I get so many customers, and once they come to me, they just don't ever go back to the other people that were doing their stuff because they realize they're getting ripped off. And I'm sure it's the same with you, Dave. You're probably the best amp tech out there. I mean, if you can build and design amps like you do, God bless you, man. That's just fantastic.
Well, thank you. You know, the thing about dealing with the other techs is, like, I always get this all the time, and I think the power transformer is bad. I like the power transformer is not bad. It's just not. It's the amount of times we've had a bad power transformer, you know, I can count on one hand. Hmm. I go, it's not a power transformer is bad. You need to look elsewhere. Some of them I don't think have ever had any experience doing any of this work because it's all, you know, like, you know, being a guy working on amps, it's years of experience is what tells you, you know, just like with any kind of thing, if you're a plumber or you're an electrician or you're a car mechanic, it's years of experience is, and seeing lots of stuff and, you know, you make mental notes as you go along in your ears. It's like, oh yeah, now I'll know to always look for that thing again. If that ever comes up, you know, after you figure out some crazy thing, like, you know, yeah. Shorted choke and a twin reverb. It's like, what? Never seen that other than once. You know, and I just don't. Some of the questions I get, it's like, I have your Dirty Shirley amp. Okay, this is basically a JTM 45 ish sort of amp, a gain stage cascaded into a gain stage. You can plain as day kind of look at it and go, oh, okay, I see what's going on roughly here. And they're just like, can I have a schematic for it so I can figure out what's going on? I go, okay, first off, what's wrong with it? Oh, well, the power fuse blew. Okay, it's got a tube rectifier in it. Replace the tube rectifier, put a new fuse in, turn it on, tell me if it works. Oh, yeah, that fixed it. Okay, why are you asking me for a schematic? I mean, like,
it's unbelievable, man.
I mean, okay, more advanced products and more advanced amps, I could understand maybe wanting to, you know, and more advanced problems, I could see maybe wanting a schematic, sure. But if you're a pretty good tech, generally you can sort of muddle through it even without and figure it out.
I very rarely look at schematics. I've just worked on so many damn amps that you just know what it's doing. What it works. Where do you look? Like you can,
hey, signal's coming in the input. Okay, hey, it's getting to the first stage. Okay, wait. Okay, gets to this gain pot. This seems good. Okay, then, oh, it must go here. Okay, you know.
Yeah.
Gets to the EQ. I'm getting plenty of voltage at the treble wiper of the EQ. Okay, great, but I'm not getting any sound after. Okay, well.
I don't know how many times people call. Are you going to say something, Mark?
No, go ahead.
I don't know how many times I get calls or an amp comes in. And I'll be out in my patio while I'm writing it up. And I just happen to look and I go, are any of the preamp tubes white? So what do you mean white? I go, you said you checked the tubes. Are any of them white? And I take the covers off or I just look in there. They don't have covers and something hit it and broke it and it's white. I go, that's why you, I go, let me go get a tubes. I get a 12AX7, put it in there. Bam. And they think you're a genius. I told you on the phone, just see if any of your tubes are white. You broke a tube is all it is. Phase over, everything stops.
Huh. So wild. Crazy. So Manuel Aparcio wants to hear a Randy Rhodes story. Do you have any Randy stories, your time hanging out with him?
Some of them I can't talk about because they're too funny and just too period correct what you could get away with back then. Now you can't get away with the stuff. But, Randy Rhodes story. I remember, and I loved Randy. I thought he was so nice and so funny and just a real gentle guy. And he was great in Quiet Riot, but we would be at his house and we'd be, you know, sitting there trading guitar licks and stuff. And he couldn't jam. He could not jam. He had to figure everything out where he was going to go against the chord changes. And it was always frustrating to me because I'm like from the, you know, the Hendrix, Frank Marino, just the riff school, just go riff, you know where you're going to go with stuff. And so that was always frustrating. And I remember I did this two riffs actually that he used both of them. One of them was a riff from Crazy Train. And they talk about it in, what's it called? Black Sabbath, Symptom of the Universe book that I gave him that riff, which I did. And then there's a riff and boo, diddle, 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 diddle. You know, there's this windy down thing. And he uses that on a couple of songs on the stuff. And every time I hear it on the radio, I go, well, there's my connection to Randy. You know? But I'll tell you.
Well, then there was the George Lynch story where he also gave a riff to Randy.
Oh, did
with
he?
The tapping or with the
pick?
Or the pick.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
I remember, and this is really sad. When I remember I was I was in this room and my dad woke me up. This is when Randy died. This was my little bedroom at my folks' house. And I remember my dad waking me up at like 7 a.m. He goes, Greg. I go, what? 7 a.m, Dad? You know, and he goes, your buddy Rocky Road died. I go, what are you talking about, Rocky Road? My dad could never get anybody's names right. I remember my sisters and I, we still laugh about this to this day. We were really into Donnie and Marie because I sang and played and my sister Nancy sang. My sister Debbie didn't really care about music back then. I remember we'd be out playing and he would yell out the door, Greg, Nancy, Dazzy, and Ozzy are on. And that was Donnie and Marie, Dazzy and Ozzy. So anyways, he wakes me up. He goes, your buddy Rocky Road died. I go, what are you talking about, Dad? He goes, it's on the TV right now. Get up. So I get up there, and they're showing the picture of the plane. And I just like, what the hell? I couldn't believe it. I called Kevin, and we're both crying on the phone. We couldn't believe it. And I remember going to the funeral. And I worked for his mother when he left to go with Ozzy. I took over all of his students at Musonia. I worked for her for, I don't know, 8 or 9 months. I had like 80 students a week. It was incredible. And I swore when I ended that I'd never give another guitar lesson because I burned out and I kept that promise to myself to this day. But I remember going to the funeral and it was so sad. And I just remember, and I've told this before, it was like a little bit of each of us died that day. It was just because we're all so close and, you know, we all knew Randy was going to do something and everybody thought I would be the next one. It was Eddie, then Randy, then it would be me and George and Carlos Cavazo and all of us that were, you know, the contemporary guys back then, but they always had better bands than I did. You know, that was the problem with me is I didn't have great enough bands and my songwriting wasn't great back then, I don't think. But anyways, I remember just going to that and just sitting there and just going, what in the fuck is it all worth? The poor guy busted his ass to become great. He made it to the top, and then he gets snuffed out over a stupid mistake in a plane. And since that, you know, I was involved in the documentary film they did on him I can't think of it. Peter Margolis did. And I don't think it's ever going to come out because the Osbournes own the music. Sharon owns the music, and she put a stop to that. And it's just a long, horrible story. It should be out. Because Rand, that stuff needs to be said, but there was so much stuff that was in the death report and stuff that nobody knows about yet, about how, I don't even want to get into this too. I cried when I heard about it, but it's just, and I remember telling my dad, you know, because it seemed like I kept getting picked over, you know, this guy would make it, or this guy get signed, or this guy, you know, and, you know, you're out there, you're drawn good, and what the hell is wrong, you know? My dad's going, you know, don't you think Randy would trade places with you in 1 minute if he could be back with his girlfriend, Jody, be hanging out with his mom, teaching guitar and just living his life? what's it worth, Greg? I mean, look at it like that. He goes, Greg, you're one of the luckiest guys in the world. You know, you're young, you're good looking back then. And, you know, you got talent. People admire you. You're doing what you want to do in life, you know, and, you know, just enjoy it for what it is, because it's not going to last forever. You know, this is a fleeting thing, the music thing. Most people never get rich doing it. They might get famous, but they got, which I've seen a million times, guys come, you know, the big, huge bands that were on MTV, they got no money. They're living back at home in their 60s. I'm like, well, dude, are you serious? You know, they're driving a 50-year-old car that, you know, if it got totaled, they'd be out $30, you know, it's ridiculous. But, you know, my dad made a lot of sense when he would talk to me. Because, you know, when you're young and you know you're good and you're playing and everybody's telling you how good you are, and it's just not happening. What the hell's wrong? What am I not doing, or what needs to happen next to you? But nobody tells you when you're young coming up how the business is, you know, and it's totally changed now. But back then, nobody knew how it was run. You know, you thought you did. You thought you get a record deal and everything was good. No, that's just where it starts, you know?
Yeah,
it's you know, a lot of, and then, you know, seeing riffs that got stolen from me, you know, on MTV. That's another thing that like drove me crazy. I would turn these, you know, to MTV on, and there's a riff of mine. And like the first Quiet Riot record with Cavazzo, half of those songs I wrote with Kevin, like Thunderbird, we wrote that in his living room. He didn't know those chords and those weird inversions. You know, that was me, and I didn't get any credit for it because I left him. He was so mad when I left. Now the second guitar player left him, you know, he had to start all over again. And he went to a bunch of people before he found Carlos, you know? So, it's a weird business, man. And I was right there just standing right next to it the whole time and just couldn't seem to get into those shoes for some reason. Yeah. You know, and all my friends, well, how come you haven't made it? You know? And I'm like, it's not for lack of trying. You know, how do you make it? What is making it?
It's, well, yeah, what is making it? And plus, you know, to get signed and to get that stardom, I mean, it was a one in a million shot. You know,
total one, and you know, they'd have to put in, you know, $500,000 just into promotion and buying you onto tours to get you out there and be seen. That doesn't happen anymore. You know, then people talk about tour support. People didn't even know what tour support was back then. That was money to buy you onto a big tour to get you seen in front of people.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
It's crazy. I'm probably boring everybody at home.
No, loving it. By the way, I only have 5 more minutes. So I got to run.
No, you don't. No, you don't. We'll do another.
No, he does.
I do. I got to run.
Are you serious?
It's been 2 hours.
It's been 2 hours.
Oh, you're right. I didn't really. Man, this felt like about 20 minutes to me.
Yeah.
It's been 2 hours.
Yeah, that's how it goes on this show. You can easily see if the talk is good, you can easily hit 4 hours.
I really, really enjoyed it, and I feel really honored to be asked to be on the show with you guys. I mean, I've done a lot of these podcasts, and this is the one that got me the most excited.
Oh, it's some fun stories. You know, it's interesting to hear this. I'd like to have Chris Holmes on, though, since you still in touch with him?
Oh, yeah. He's in Paris now.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
He was supposed to come and buy a Lexicon PCM 41 off me. And then I guess his pop died while he was here and he didn't have time to stop by, but we talk, I don't know, maybe 4 times, 5 times a year since he's been over there. He was always over here at the house. That he scared the hell out of my mom one time. My mom didn't know who he was, and he had shorts on and he's all tatted up and he looked just like a monster almost. And he's like 6'6". And my mom and I were in my little MG, and it was before she died. I don't drive around with a corpse in my car. So we're sitting at a gas station. We're sitting at a gas station, and he sees me, and he starts walking over to the car. And my mom's going, roll up the window. I go, Mom, I can't. You got to roll up the window. There's no power windows in this thing. So this guy's coming over here. I go, Mom, that's a friend of mine, Chris. She goes, he's scaring me. He's, you know, he looked like a monster. He's all tatted up, and he's got this crazy hair and this big, huge beard. And so he comes to the car, and he goes, hello, Mrs. Leon. How are you? So nice to meet you. And he was so proper. And my mom just laughed when we drove away. She goes, oh, he was so nice. I've known Chris since I was 19. Yeah, he's a nice guy. I miss him being around because there's only one Chris Holmes, man. There's nobody like him. Nobody.
Well, we'll have to get him on.
Yeah, he's been, he seems like he's doing pretty good now. He went through a lot of hard times too there.
Oh, yeah.
You know, but he seems like he's, in recent things I've seen, he seems like he's together and like kind of, you know.
Yeah, well, he got off all the nonsense stuff, and
yeah,
you know, but yeah, he went through some shit, and then you know,
the, some cancer stuff and all that stuff. Yeah.
You know, and then just what he felt that Blackie did to him, you know, taking all the money and stuff, and that was hard on him too. That'll kill you if you come up with all those riffs and somebody else got rich off it. Oh man, that's brutal.
I mean, of course, I'll never forget seeing him in that documentary.
Nobody will.
Yeah, no one will. That's the most famous scene ever.
Is that the one? Is that the one where he poured urine all over his face and was drinking it?
Or vodka?
It was vodka.
It was, I'm just joking. It wasn't urine.
Yeah.
It was. I mean, I remember seeing that. I mean, I was a kid when I saw that. I mean, I was probably like 18 when that, I saw that when it came out.
Yeah.
When did that? You know, that document, Decline of the Western
Civilization. Yeah. I mean, I don't remember. Yeah, I was probably 18 or something. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember seeing it. I was like with my friends. We were like, "Holy shit!" That's
it's funny. It's funny when you watch it now and you see some of the bands that were, "Oh, I'm gonna make it," or "I'm gonna do this or this." Oh, now it's sort of like watching it today. You're like, "Oh, this is a sad state." you know, like oh, the guy's in Odin or something. Yeah, you know?
That's who I was thinking of.
Yeah.
Bringing it to you, by the way. Thanks for creating the IRX. I'm in tone heaven.
Great.
That's nice.
Oh, yeah. Dave has more stuff coming.
Yeah, you know, someone said we should actually try to have Penelope Spheris on our show.
That would be cool. The director and the producer.
Of Decline and Fall of Western Civilization. She also did Wayne's World and a bunch of other stuff over the years. But and then someone said we should invite David Black to be on too as a reunion.
Oh yeah, that would be cool as fuck.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, I'm sorry, guys. I got a bolt in like 5 minutes.
I really enjoyed this. You guys are awesome. I hope that you enjoyed having me on your show.
Oh, absolutely.
Anytime you want to do another one or whatever, I'm going to come over and see you, Dave, one of these days. Are you still in the same place behind
me? Yeah, still here.
Over there, yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, or I should come up and see your studio or whatever.
Yeah, anytime, man. You'll love it. You'll love it.
Tell people to where they can reach you, Greg, and you know, and you know, for you to fix your amps, and also where they can hear your music.
Well, they can call me. They can go online at gregleoninvasion@hotmail.com, or they can buy the record. Any of my music is all available everywhere. Just go online, punch in Greg Leon Invasion, and the latest one is called Tell the Children, and it's available. Or you, I don't know if I should give my phone number out right now because my phone will never stop ringing.
Probably shouldn't give the phone number.
But they can reach me through my email, or they can, they can't text me because I'm not going to give the phone number. But
yeah.
I'm easy to find. I mean, you can go online. I mean, I'm the easiest guy to find. I'm surprised the police haven't got me yet.
Maybe after this interview.
Yeah, there he is. That's him.
We found him. I think the next show that we're going to do is we'll do Ask Dave probably before the end of the month. And then
we're going to have to squeeze that in.
Or maybe.
We can squeeze it in maybe the week after NAMM.
Okay. Yeah. And then we have, I spoke to Adam Nolly.
Yeah.
And he's back in. I think we landed on, because remember he's in.
Yeah, Europe. It's got to be a Saturday.
Gotta be a Saturday, so we possibly talk maybe February 10th with Adam.
February 10th. Oh yeah, your guitar.
Yes, let's talk about that, Greg, before we go.
Oh well, it's a 1966 Fender Telecaster, all original, except for the brass plates on the bridge here. I got this in a trade. I traded a bass guitar that I had $60 into it. And I got this, but it did not look like this when I got it. It would have been sanded down. The pickups were original. The neck was original. It says 66 right in there, the date on it. The headstock had been sanded off that where it says Fender, but we found a, transitional period logo for it. And a really great guitar tech that I met. I do guitar work too, but this guy paints, and he's just the best. His name's Matty Barato. He's
I know Matty.
The best of the best of, and I've met everybody just about in Southern California.
He's a sweetheart.
He's a, I love him. Yeah. We go to lunch and stuff. So, anyways, I just happened to meet him the day or two after I got this, and it looked like shit. I mean, it looked like $60, but I knew the neck felt amazing, and it's a maple cap, which always sound good. No skunk stripe. So, anyways, he sees it and he goes, "Let me take it." And so I did a couple of amp repairs for him. And he returned this. We did a custom nitrocellulose finish. Nice. He did. I didn't do it. With Dakota Red. And he refretted it. And just beautiful. The original pickups. I've got 50. I think I have 52 guitars. And without a doubt, this is one of the best sounding guitars I've ever heard. And one of the best playing guitars I've ever heard. Hmm. And I've been using it every recording I've been doing. When I'm layering, I use this. And it's just magical. I never knew Telecasters could be this good. I've been a Les Paul and Strat guy my whole life, and Jaguar. But I just am completely in love with that.
Is the neck fat, or is it a thinner neck?
Oh, it's thin. It's wonderful. And this 56 Les Paul Jr., the neck is not that fat either on it. It's really comfortable. I mean, I could wrap my thumb all the way around it.
$190. Yeah,
that's great. Between those two and that 71 Marshall, I think you got a pretty penny.
I'm the luckiest guy, man. I mean, I've had so many wonderful gifts, and there's just so much love out there. But you know, you get love when you give love. So I think people need to be nice to each other and treat people the way they want to be, because it comes back tenfold. It really does.
Yeah, it does. Totally.
And you know, Dave, people love you. Your name comes up in my shop all the time. They just speak highly of you. And, you know, it's because you treat people like they're humans and they're friends. And that's why I look at, until somebody screws me over, I treat them the way I want to be treated. Once they do that, they're dead to me. That's because I'm Italian. And that's the way it works, my friend. It's a shame you're going to have a problem here. I love this. I thought it was, I can't believe 2 hours have gone. It feels like 20 minutes. It just
flies by, man.
Yeah.
Bye. Well, yeah, we'd love to have you back, Greg. And thank you so much for coming on. I really, you know, you're just a pleasure to speak to. So
right. I feel the same way. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Your stories are great. And
there's 100 more, over 100 more.
Well, probably. That's why it's, you have to think about ones you didn't talk about.
I told Mark yesterday, don't get me started, because I won't shut up. I want people to know.
It's okay. We like that. It makes our job a lot easier, because we don't have to pry anything out of people.
I just think, you know,
it's more like we just sit there and listen ourselves. You know, we're watching our own show.
It would be fun is if I come out to California, I'd love to have a drink with you. You know,
that'd be awesome.
Yeah.
I like drinking.
Be nice to hang and talk. But guys, make sure you hit subscribe and hit the bell, click the bell and all that stuff. And again, Sweetwater, fixpedalboards.com, Tomon. And we want to thank Greg really for coming on. And
yeah, thanks, Greg.
Check us out on our social media stuff. But again, we'll send out like a notification on when the next show is. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody have a great Friday, great weekend. And we'll talk to you soon. Greg, hang on.
Hang on one second, Greg, while we sign off.
Take care, guys.